Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. Welcome. I'm your host, Cyrus Polisbon, and I'm joined today by Zohar Atkins and Nicolas Sarian. Welcome, guys. The quote that we're going to cover this week is by Charlemagne, King Charlemagne, and it reads, "Right action is better than knowledge, but in order to do what is right, we must know what is right." Your thoughts?
It reminds me of a similar quotation from the ancient rabbis. It was actually a debate about which is greater, study or action. One side said study is greater than action, and the other side said that action is greater than study. And then Rabbi Akiva says he resolves the debate, although I think his resolution is quite paradoxical. He says study is greater, for study leads to action. A couple things to say about this debate, which is greater, study or action. One is every society lives within a regime of values. And the modern regime tends to favor action over contemplation. The ancients tended to value contemplation or study over action. Here we have the emphasis on action over study. It's almost the inverse of Rabbi Akiva's point, which makes it modern, that action is better than knowledge. But knowledge perhaps is better than action insofar as it's instrumentally necessary to get to action. And that's what I wanted to discuss with you guys. Is Charlemagne right that knowledge is a necessary ingredient or necessary driver of right action? Or can you circumvent knowledge and arrive at right action without getting right knowledge? So I'll put a couple more things on the table here. I'm obsessed with this question. One is, in investing, there are two opposite approaches on this question. We'll call the approach that values action over study the green lumber approach. I'll describe what the green lumber approach is in a second. And on the other is the knowledge over action, which largely characterizes like a Warren Buffett or a Charlie Munger. So Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett make about a couple investments a year. And there have been some years where they make zero investments. They're very patient investors, perhaps the most patient investors. And the reason why they do very little is because they will only make an investment if they have deep conviction, plus what they call a margin of safety, which means on top of their conviction, or perhaps this is another way of saying they have conviction, they won't do anything where there's a chance they could go haywire. They build into their thesis, even the worst case scenario is a positive scenario for them. They will not buy any stock that they don't deeply understand. And for that reason, they passed on a number of investments over the years that would have done quite well for them. For example, Amazon, Microsoft, a lot of incredible tech stocks. They missed on Google, and they bought Apple. Their investment in Apple was one of their best investments, but they only bought Apple late in the game on a relative basis. And the reason is because they didn't understand these things technologically or technically. They're also super anti-Bitcoin. Munger says that Bitcoin is worthless. It's worth less than anything. And in large part because they don't understand these things. The green lumber approach is the opposite approach. The green lumber is named after a trader who was very successful trading something called green lumber. He made a lot of money, and he thought that the lumber was green, and that's why it's called green lumber. It turns out the lumber wasn't green. It was normal lumber, but that was just the name of the company. And the point is that you don't need to know the actual thing that you're trading. You only need to know some things about it. And what matters from being a good trader is having the right knowledge, but not necessarily the holistic knowledge. So you can extrapolate from the green lumber point the idea that you don't need to know fundamental reality. You just need to know, let's say, the price action of something to extend the point even further, let's say that I believe in somebody's authority. On that person's authority, I pursue that which they believe in, even though I myself have no knowledge of that thing. If you go with that approach, then let's say you could have bought Bitcoin at $100. Now it's at trading at $45,000 or something. You could have made a 450,000x return or whatever. Not because you knew what Bitcoin was, but simply because you thought that there was a chance that it could be worth a lot more based upon the authority of other people. Now, how does this relate to knowledge and action? If you value knowledge, then you're a Warren Buffett type of person. And basically, you're very cautious, which means all of your errors will be errors of omission. And if you're an action over study kind of person, then I would put it in the terms of you're more of a green lumber person, where you're saying, listen, whether I know what the fundamentals are right now is irrelevant. Let me just take action. And maybe if I'm lucky later on, I'll learn. And I might even learn something as a result of taking action. So just to close the loop, and I'll kick it over to Nico. In Jewish tradition, there's a famous line in the Bible, in Exodus, where the people say regarding the acceptance of the Torah, we will do it, and then we will understand it. Na'aseh v'nishma. We will do the Torah, we will obey it, and then we will come to understand why we're doing it or what we're doing. And this is taken in the interpretive tradition as effectively the green lumber point, which is to say, don't wait to understand the Torah, because if you do, you'll never observe it. Rather, cultivate in Charlemagne's terms, the right action, and then the right understanding will come to you. So I think this debate remains a great dialectic in the history of thought, and I should say in the history of action. And we moderns, regardless of our own personal preferences, probably have through osmosis accepted the preference for action, which means that it's more contrarian to be Warren Buffett right now. We live in a society of green lumber. The patience of only making one decision a year is probably the less common one. So in the ancient world, it would have been the reverse. The contrarian thing would have been to be a person who just said, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to understand it. And then that was a kind of anti-philosophical position in a time when philosophers had great esteem. Now philosophers are reduced to the margins. So we see the pendulum, if you will, swings back and forth between the rule by philosophers and the rule by engineers and financiers.
Sarah, do you want to make me a question or?
No, Zohar posed a question to us. I think timing matters. I think urgency matters in the situation. Warren Buffett can afford. Warren Buffett can afford to wait, for example. He can afford to wait and take the right action. And me personally, many of my friends and family know me that I used to be notorious for waiting and getting all the information before I did anything. And then when I did, I do it quickly and get it done. But sometimes you can't wait. Like, life goes by, and not even just life and death situations, which you're not likely to find in modern life. But in, let's say, a relationship or dating, the best thing to do is to make a sure, definitive action or lose the interest of the other person. Sometimes timing does matter. Some people aren't going to wait around all day. Or here in business, as the three of us are co-founders of Lightning. When you asked me, Cyrus, are you ready to commit and ready to go all out? It was around like October, I think, when you said that. And I had two indie films about the film at the time. But I wasn't going to say, I don't know, Zohar, let's just wait on that. I'm a little packed right now. No, like, timing matters, and like, just the attitude matters in this, and confidence. So I said, yes, like, let's do it. And I made it happen. So, and this always happens in my conversations with Francis. He says, just do it, learn on the fly. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs learn on the fly.
So my
answer is timing matters.
So timing is the function or the mechanism that leads to action being preferable to knowledge? Or are you saying in a world without timing, we could gather more information and thus act on the basis of knowledge, but because we live in a time-sensitive world, action becomes, raises in status?
It becomes a scale. Yeah, it's a gradient. Like, how urgent and how much time do you have?
Nice.
I guess
What's isn't it sort of false though that we have a sense of urgency? I think that's what the Warren Buffetts would say, is that this feeling of urgency is all in your head. There is no urgency. I think another way to frame the question is, do you want your errors to be errors of omission or errors of commission? Meaning, do you want your mistakes to be mistakes of you missed out because you didn't take action? Or do you want your mistakes to be mistakes of you took action and you did the wrong action? Which do you think is more value destructive? Not doing something? And I'm not saying about a specific situation. I'm almost saying which is your pattern. Yeah, I guess it's personal. It's philosophical as well. If we take a zoom out of our lives, right, you can add up all your mistakes. Are those mistakes going to be in the column that's the column of I didn't take enough action? Or in the column of I was way too busy, I was way too neurotic, way too driven by FOMO or the sense of if I'm not doing something, then it's bad. And therefore, I made terrible mistakes.
Personally, most of mine are omission. And they're by far carry the most bitterness later on, most regret, rather than bitterness up front, where you're like, damn it. You don't think about them immediately. Like when you make a mistake due to your action, it hits you right then and there. But then you find a way to live with it. And it justifies probability. At least I did something. You learn from it. You learn from me. I made the wrong choice as opposed to I didn't do anything. I waited. And who knows what would have happened if I did it.
How do you know?
Yeah, you don't know.
You cannot anticipate the consequences of your actions, whether they're right or wrong. But not per Charlemagne, but I think the quote... I don't know. I think I have lots of things in my mind and I'm trying to organize what I'm going to say, because I can go in different directions per Zohar's commentary. But I have one pressing question, which underscores the quote a little bit. And my question is, theory and praxis, or for that matter, knowledge and action, thinking and action, no? Divorceable at all? Because we tend to divorce them all of the time, or we've been taught to divorce doing and thinking. I think Zohar is going to I'm gonna smile a little bit because you can read this in a specific way, but because I believe that, I don't know, it's a bag of cats, it's a Pandora's box, but how do we interpret what we do all of the time? Because there's this famous phrase by Marx that says, philosophers have interpreted the world, the point is to change it, no? The question then is, okay, so how do you change the world? By thinking or by doing? And this is the, Marx says, no, you have to go and do the revolution. But it's thinking, no? Thinking is carrying that whole dilemma, I think, at the end of the day. And to go back to Cyrus's point of omissions or not having done what you should have done, let's say the right thing to do, I would say that you can only know the consequences of your actions once you do them. If you don't do them, you don't know. You don't know if it was a missed opportunity or a good choice. Of course, there's like a pop psychology thing to the whole thing, which is like, oh, when I was like 15 or when I was 25, oh, I missed that opportunity. My life would have been different. What I'm interested in that scenario is analyzing the resentment, not so much the fact that the person didn't do what they did before.
The regret.
Yeah, it's where is that regret coming from? It's not coming from not having done what you thought would have been done, should have been done. I think that the resentment is coming from present situation of not doing anything right now about where you are, you know? My big question is like, we tend to divorce thinking from action, and I don't believe that's possible, or it's a hypocrisy, really.
I hear your point, Nico, and it's very clever. And I think I agree at the deepest level that they're inseparable. That's one of the points of Heidegger and of phenomenology is that thinking is a kind of practice and action is always carrying with it some implicit understanding. That being said, let's not be too clever. Let's just be anthropologists or sociologists and look at society. And you can clearly see that there are places in society where taking action is highly esteemed, in pockets where thinking is highly esteemed. You see this as early as the playground in kindergarten, where the strong jocks or soon to be jocks take prey upon the scrawny nerds, and then the nerds get their revenge 30 years later when they become tech bros. And Mark Zuckerberg enslaves them all. There's something to this archetype. There's something to the archetype of academics who have these wonderful theories, maybe even true theories, but are unable to get society to go along with these theories because they lack the focus on execution, or they lack the charisma necessary to message these theories and get them adopted. Just look at politicians, or most politicians. They're very good at mobilizing crowds. There's an action in campaigning. Totally not the same skill set as the action, as the understanding needed to pass good policies. You're very lucky if a politician who simultaneously knows how to rouse a crowd also by happenstance knows how to think about trade-offs and what's good for society, but it's not obvious why those two skill sets go together. And thus you often have, and this is not even a political point, this is a metapolitical point, populists and demagogues who really capitalize on society's preference for the man of action, the person of action, over the person of thought. Think of Hamlet. Cyrus, you mentioned, used to be a person who wanted to gather information before taking action. Hamlet is the consummate figure of somebody who wants to be sure before he makes any decision, spends the whole play trying to prove with certainty that his father has been murdered by his stepfather. And eventually he does take action, but one critique of Hamlet that we can have, especially when he even says to be or not to be, is that he's an overthinker. And that a different person would have avoided this tragedy altogether by just seeing the obvious and doing something about it. But he's all in his head. I used to play a game with friends that was based upon this Hamlet concept. There's an independent film, a Canadian film, called Teenager Hamlet. I recommend it to listeners. It's not necessarily in the canon, but it's in the alt canon. And the filmmaker goes around asking people to tell their life story, essentially, I believe largely teenagers, through the lens of the following question: do you identify more with Hamlet or with Ophelia? And then it's basically just people saying, I'm Ophelia because X, Y, and Z. And just for the listeners, just to recap the story, Ophelia is Hamlet's girlfriend who goes mad and drowns herself. And she's a foil to Hamlet, where Hamlet is the man of caution, a man who can't be in relationship with Ophelia because he's too much in his own thoughts. And Ophelia, if you will, is the person, I'm now going to interpolate a little bit, but it almost is the person of reckless action who brings herself to self-destruction because she's so impulsive. This suggests, it's a bit bleak, but Nico will appreciate my diabolical tendency here. Our choices, if you will, archetypally, are between the neurotic and the psychotic. Hamlet is the neurotic, Ophelia the psychotic. The psychotic is the person who takes action without thought. The neurotic is the person who is immersed in thought but unable to execute.
I would disagree with the distinction, but not on the categories. No, because I wouldn't say it's neurotic or psychotic. I would say, and this is much in vogue these days, being a psychopath versus a sociopath. Everybody likes to make this distinction today.
Okay, so what's the distinction?
The distinction can be explained through Freudian topics, which is both of them have an... Okay, no.
Just give us
both
the one sentence.
Both of them have an ego.
What's the one sentence?
Yeah, okay.
Definition.
No, but I'm going for the one sentence. The psychopath has a very strong superego, but does not have an ego. There is no ego there. And this is why it's like close to being a psychotic person. The sociopath doesn't have a superego. So it's pure id and there's no rules. They just see each thing for its own, let's say, schism. Or like a psychopath is someone who imagines grand narratives and here's the word of God and all of this, I don't know, nonsense. Another discussion. But a sociopath is just someone who sees everything as a means to a marginal end with no, let's say, grand narrative. Yeah.
Wait, so the psychopath has all superego? Is that what you said? The psychopath?
Yeah, okay.
Could you explain for any listeners who may not know the difference between an ego and a superego, just real quick?
That's not the one-liner, but I'll try and do it. So in Freud, there's three things. There's the ego, there's the superego, and then there's the id. No? The id is, I'm going to explain it from bottom to top. The id is the most, let's say, call it unconscious part or subconscious part of the whole structure of the topic. Topics is just the German term that he uses for each, by which there is no, it's pure pulsion. There is no control. The ego is in the middle, dealing with all of that, no? With all of that id, and trying to control it, to maintain stability amongst the incessant drives that come from the id. And the superego is your morality, your religion, your like great, let's say, structures of order, of law, of behavior, which are not a matter of the ego or dealing with everyday vicissitudes. And it's just like the big stuff. Which is beyond your,
I'm gonna add a little bit onto this and just say that in light of a previous podcast episode, the superego is the sun and the id is the moon. So we had that beautiful quote about the moonlight versus sunlight.
Yes.
Because in Nietzsche, the Apollonian, Apollo, is associated with the sun, and the Dionysian, who's associated with the moon. Dionysus was a god of intoxication and ecstasy, thus the id. Apollo is logic, reason, mathematics, grand narratives, thus the sun. So there are parts of ourselves that are clear and distinct, that we do out in the open. And then there are parts of ourselves that are repressed or reclusive or unconscious. And the ego is the product of that conflict, is these simultaneously mediating that war and mediated or produced by that war. Now, Freud didn't just come up with this in a vacuum. He was influenced by German idealism, which there were a bunch of thinkers after Kant that were German idealists. The biggest ones were Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel. And all of those guys had a view of the self as a kind of creative emergent process that where the self is born through an internal process of friction and simultaneous identification with oneself and disidentification with oneself. And also Nietzsche also came after this tradition and influenced Freud. And so the idea is you are yourself and not yourself at the same time, and thus you have to produce a synthesis of those two things, the fact that you are yourself and not yourself, which leads to a higher self, which is the resolution of this conflict between self-identity and self-difference. Now, as that relates to Freud, the point is the part of yourself that is produced through this conflict will be the ego. The part of yourself that is not identified with yourself will be the id. And the part of yourself that identifies with itself will be the superego, which is essentially like the attempt to reconcile yourself to the fact that you're in conflict with yourself or something like this. Again, there's different ways of doing it. And then just like one last point on this, which is the German idealists did not get this in a vacuum either. The idea of the self as a tripartite function, having three parts, actually goes all the way back to Plato. If you look at the Phaedrus, that's one of the prime places where Plato or even Socrates talks about the self as having these conflicting drives, as well as the Phaedrus by Plato. It's a place where we're described as having conflicting drives, as well as the ability to resolve these conflicts. And the image that Plato uses is that the self is simultaneously a white horse, a black horse, and a charioteer that yokes the two horses together with a guy on the backs of both horses or being drawn by both horses with a whip, trying to keep these two horses together and carrying him to where he needs to go. Now, in the parable, if you will, the white horse is reason, so Apollo and the sun. the black horse is inspiration, passion, love, intoxication, and madness. And it doesn't do what the white horse wants. It goes off the path. It's just, it sees something and it's, ooh, that's exciting. And then the charioteer that is on the one hand saying the white horse is right and I need to follow the white horse and come over here, black horse. Boom, boom, boom. The black horse is also onto something because the black horse has the passion which leads and follows beauty, which leads to the highest places, whereas the rational faculty without the black horse would never get to this higher place. So it's a bit, that's where Freud is really drawing all of this stuff from, is that the id is the black horse, the ego is the charioteer, and the white horse is the superego, something to this effect. Or maybe Nico would flip it and say that the superego is the guy cracking the whip. But I think that the superego is a drive ultimately. The ego is the one that harnesses the two conflicting drives together into one identity. There's a drive to be moral and to be upright, and there's also a drive to be bad, if you will. And there's relationship coaches who, like Esther Perel, in a way, popularizes these ideas where if you have too much sort of rationality in a relationship, it's not exciting. If you have too much madness in a relationship, it's not stable. So how do you find the right balance, or how do you manage that tension between the white horse and the black horse, right? Because if you don't have a certain routine or regularity, then you don't have a relationship. You're not building a home. But if it's so routine, then perhaps there isn't the romance element. So anyways, the Freudian ideas, which he put in one person's mind, you can also extrapolate to dynamics between people as well.
Why do you think the ego, the word, has such a negative connotation in today's society? I feel like it mirrors the preference towards action instead of knowledge.
Yeah.
The shunning of the ego and the favor of the it.
I wouldn't say that people, let's say, have this definition of the ego by association with the id or with the Freudian stuff. It's just that, because I know what you're talking about, like ego death and all of these things that everybody talks about today.
But is it the guy has a big ego?
I think it's if people associate egoism with narcissism today, and that's not what we're talking about. Or pop psychology, self-help has proliferated the use of the ego, of the term ego, to refer to basically the source of your anxiety or the source of your despair and angst. Because the idea being that there is such a thing called an ego, call it an image of yourself, and you associate, you identify with it. And because of this identification, you suffer. I think that's like the mundane understanding what people mean by ego, because then it's, I want to have a nice LSD trip or some ayahuasca or whatever and experience ego death. I don't think that experience ego death is a nice experience because what you get is the psychopath. You get the superego and the id, and you're totally lost in that whole sublime experience, to put it in a Kantian way. But if I could offer some sort of, let's say, more rigorous understanding of why the ego is bad, it's not ego. The egoity is not the problem. The problem is, and this is a Nietzschean thing, is individuation, which means that what's the benefit of being one, of being an individuated in life, when there is a multiplicity of drives?
I don't understand.
The LGBT... What? No, like you can explain this through like how the LGBT crowd like might understand this, which is if I have different scenarios in life, or even not in life, but just on a weekly basis, where I'm triggered and I'm ticked and I'm infatuated and conditioned to behave or think about myself in a different way every day of the week, then why should I be called, I don't know, Martha? Or why should I be one person? Why can I be multiple? It is funny, but
wait, how does that relate to the point on ego? Like, I are you saying it's a critique of the ego?
Because
I think it's hyper egotistical.
What I would say, that's what I'm saying. This is like mundane kind of
Not enough to be Martha. Now you want to be, you also prosaic, want to be Jane.
It is a form of capriciousness of having to like settle with one form of, let's say, not even identity, but indexicality towards another person. And what do I mean by this is that the problem is not you. The problem is that in front of another person, there is one person there. And being referred to as one instead of many, or in, let's say, in like non-gendered speech, they, it is missing the point, which is, it's not about what you think about yourself. It's about what other people think about you. That's what makes an ego, not what you think about yourself. Because you're individuated in the... I'm sorry, I might be going off the tangent, but you become individuated not because of what you think about yourself, just because there is another person in front of you. That's individuation. Individuation is not, I'm this and I'm such and such, I think about myself in all of these ways. Individuation happens when you have to face with the fact that there's another person in the room and you have to deal with them on a one-to-one basis.
It's like a quantum particle in all locations at once until it's observed.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the point. Yeah.
Nico, I'm sure what you're saying is very deep and insightful, but I didn't follow what is at stake in it. This is exactly the point about thought versus action, is bring it home in terms of what does the average mind think about this and why are they living in the wrong way? And what is the correct interpretation and how can it help us? Are you saying people misunderstand what individuation is? It's, they think it's this, but it's really this. And as a result, they're not living a good life. Get moralistic and sermonize for us. What do we need to be doing?
Okay.
Not just thinking. Like, I don't know. Need to enjoy it and this is how. Because otherwise, it's too intangible for me.
I understand, but what I could offer is the following, is that we feel a lot of things. Everybody has a bunch of different emotions and ideas that are, we are a channel for a lot of things, no? That we don't know where those things come from, those emotions, those thoughts. The point is to grapple with those and not, let's say, understand that each one of those is a separate identity. Yeah. Because that's when you get philosophically it's problematic, but the point being that being individuated is not a choice. Like it's a condition. I don't know like how to say this, but because what Nietzsche, the whole trip about what Nietzsche hated was that, oh, there is this thing called the Principium Individuationis, which is associated to Apollo. Basically put it egoicity, like being an I, being, let's say, a unified. And what's the problem with that is that you're cut off from the world. You're a subject in front of the world, and there is no union there. That's why he likes Dionysus so much, because the Dionysiac experience is to put it, I don't know, theologically, it's a unio mystica. It's a union with everything. It's a mystical experience. And I think everybody wants that. The problem is that you don't get one without the other. Let's say you need, if you want to become, let's say, fused with life, you need to be one person that goes through destruction. You're not going to go through that and then remain yourself. This is the consequence. Yeah. If you want that, you have to, in a sense,
I'll tell you how I relate to it in my terms. It may or may not be Nietzschean. I'm going to bring in a little bit of a Jewish or biblical tradition. So I suppose Nietzsche would disagree. But in some weird ways, I feel that Nietzsche is totally in agreement with what I'm like a Nietzschean rabbi. I think God wants us to be existentialists. We are socialized by our parents, by our peers, by authority figures from a young age, unconsciously and unconsciously, to double down on the things for which we are esteemed. I'm obviously speaking about the average. I can't speak to every edge case or outlier. We're not talking about people who are radically neglected or radically abused or that kind of. But I think on average, we have mirror neurons, which get activated when we see other people's faces, and when we get a positive face, that lights up a positive face in the back of our brain, and we just do those things that will get more positive faces back at us, and we try not to do the things that are going to get the negative faces back to us, unless with exceptions. And what that ends up doing is it turns us into strength addicts. I'm not the only person to say this. This is pop psychology as well. But a strength addict would be somebody who is addicted to doing that which they're good at because they get a social reward for it. And the reason why that's a problem is that it means that you won't do things which you end up becoming resistant to change and resistant to trying new things and doing anything in which you'd be an amateur or weak because you don't want to be perceived as a failure. And the older that you get and the more practiced you are at excelling in some area, in a way, the more you get away with this strength addiction and people just continue to praise you. Oh, yes, you're so smart. You're so this. And that locks you in to a certain way of being. And then you come to identify with that. You say, I am a this. And that thing that you identify with is the history of the accumulation of all that social reward. And what you really want to be is a person who constantly changes and grows and explores your edges. In order to do that, though, you need to not be a strength addict, and you have to wean yourself off of that addiction. Often it's said that addiction is connected to like low self-esteem, meaning you are behind the addiction is the fact that you get a certain conditional love, certain dopamine feeling, and you need that in order to feel good. If you could accept critical feedback from the world or from other people or from yourself, it wouldn't be the end of the world if you did something else. But for a lot of people, that's scary. And thus you have strength addicts in the form of nerds who just keep doing the thing that they were good at in school and don't branch out. You have strength addicts in the form of athletes, if that's where they got their value from. At some point, unless you hit a crisis where you can no longer do that thing, you could probably get away with that strength addiction for your whole life. But some people, for whatever reason, either because of external or internal reason, realize that they want to grow and they want to change and that they want to get rid of this strength addiction and come to a deeper understanding of themselves and appreciation for themselves that isn't tied to the social reward and this conditional love. And that is what I would call individuation. I think very few people actually manage to achieve it. And it's not really an achievement. It's more of a process because you never get to the end of figuring out who you are, but you can develop a practice of putting yourself in new relationships and new situations that constantly challenge you. And to the people who say you have to be Martha and Jane, whoever's saying this, our straw people, right? Not our straw man.
Yeah.
Our straw people. You can be multiple and individual by trying lots of new things and doing it as one unified self. The idea that you have to be a different person in a different context is the antithesis of the idea that, no, I am Zohar as much when I'm teaching on Heidegger, as I am when I'm leading prayer for the Jewish congregation, as much as when I am trying to understand what would make it invisible a better culture, as much as I am when I'm a parent and my kids are crying and I've got to figure out how to manage the chaos. It's not like I'm 10 different people and I'm just a bunch of drives. I'm a person who finds integrity through this multiplicity. And the integrity, this is where I think a religious language helps. That's almost like that's the soul. The thing that keeps it all together is the signature of the self, which is a very mysterious concept. I don't really understand it. It sounds old-fashioned and metaphysical. But I think this is when it says in the Bible that God created the human being in the divine image. This is roughly my interpretation, which is God is a God of becoming, a God who is on a self-exploration as well. The creation of the world is God's own self-exploration, his own attempt at integrity through multiplicity, and the risk of becoming that necessarily is activated by introducing all kinds of chaos and all kinds of friction. And we are gifted with the ability to emulate that, but most of us don't take up that journey. Most of us live in arrested development, and a chosen few are blessed with the burden, the anguished burden of becoming life artists. And religions and sects and movements are an attempt to scale that out and create a certain fidelity to this. And what happens when they do this is that they run into the problem of scaling values, which is that they get diluted the more you grow a community around them. And it's filled with virtue signalers and people who are in it for all the wrong reasons. Nonetheless, perhaps there is a moral progress or a psychological progress that comes from the attempt to take this understanding and build a shelter for it. And we call that shelter right action, just to bring it back to Charlemagne.
I was going to say that, like, when I was talking about individuation, because I guess you hinted to this, Zohar, I explicitly said it was Nietzschean, because there's another way of understanding individuation, which is closer to what you were talking about, which is the Jungian understanding of individuation. Yeah.
An individual literally means someone who is not divided, who is not divisible. And so the in Talmud, we call it the Havamina. The Havamina means what is the presumption that's encoded in the language. So what is the Havamina of the phrase individual? The hava mina of individual is that you are divisible. So the presumption is that you're divisible. The word individual and the word individuation means, despite the fact that you think that you're divisible, you're really not. Or you must not let it be. You must find a way to shelter yourself from the forces that are constantly pulling you apart. And bringing back to the superego and the id, those forces do pull us apart. So that suggests that a healthy ego, this comes back to Cyrus's point, will be an ego that is successful at not just feeling like it's at the whim of different drives, but despite the fact that it's got all of these drives, does manage to feel strong enough to hold that, to hold all of that complexity and almost rise above it, to identify as the one that manages that chaos. And in the ancients, the word economic was the fusion of two words, oikos meaning house and nomos meaning law. So economics was the law of the house. And the early church fathers referred to heaven as a divine economy, where the role of God was to manage the divine house. That was how the Trinitarians understood. By the way, it's interesting that the Trinitarians believed that there was a tripartite aspect to God, just as we've been talking about a tripartite aspect to the site. And God, as it were, has to hold together in heaven all of those different forces as well that parallels our need to hold together these competing forces. There isn't just an id versus a superego down below, if you will. God also, speaking with poetic license, God also has an ego, an id, and a superego. The superego of God, perhaps, is the God who has justice. The id of God is the God who wants to do whatever he wants, which in the Bible is mercy. And the ego is the adjudicator between those two, which we are told in the Jewish and Christian tradition that God favors mercy. So even though there's two voices in God's head, one saying destroy the people because they're a bunch of sinners, and another saying spare them because you love them, the ego's tie goes to mercy. So the burden is on justice to be almost super just. If it's just, then God is going to defer perfect justice for the sake of mercy. And that's one of the explanations for why there's evil in the world, is because the world isn't just, because on some level God is loving and forgives sin, thus enabling evildoers to get away with it. And sparing creation is cruel and merciful at the same time.
Zohar, can I ask you a question?
For sure.
Do you believe, or do you think that people live their life or behave as if evil is real, as if there is such a thing as evil? Some people do, of course. Some people do.
I think 90% of the world does, but like elites who are college educated don't. It's almost like the more modern and westernized you are, the more you think that evil is just a backwards way of labeling. That person just has a bad. They just had a bad social condition, the wrong zip code, or unlucky. I think most people are like, no, that person's a force of evil, or there's a force of evil that runs through them, or even that whole society and that culture is evil in some way. And that's how we operated for most of human history. So I was actually recently reading an interview with this Tyler Cowen interviewed this guy, Patrick McKenzie, who works in fintech. He's like an engineer. and the topic was bank fraud. And he said that there's a certain amount of bank fraud that can be explained simply by the existence of evil. And that he thinks most people, like in the world of fintech, because they don't appreciate evil because they're in a bubble, like they don't understand that there is just a certain percentage of crime that is evil. And so it was he took on the question almost as an economics question, where he was saying, yeah, okay, fine. A certain percentage of it isn't evil. It's X, Y, and Z, but like 10, 20% is evil. So maybe I'd say the average understanding overestimates how much evil there is in the world, but the like elite understanding underestimates how much evil there is in the world.
So which horse do we choose to favor?
I think we're all elite. So right. I think we should make a little bit of room in our hearts to consider the possibility of evil in others and in ourselves. Again, once you do, then we would talk about what is evil. Great. I obviously, a mystical or non-dual appreciation would say that evil is just part of the, it's in a way normal.
You got two bonus.
God's got to balance his books. Evil is just the red. There's good deeds and good things, which are the green, the assets. And then there's just liabilities, debt, so to say, God's debt. But also, I think it's truly dependent. What I mean by that is quite a can of worms to open it, like at the finish line here. But in an ancient society where there were just certain things that were done that we today would never do, marrying children off at the age of 10 years old or whatever, owning slaves, eating the limbs off of live animals, just all kinds of crazy stuff. In our day and age, all of that is on some level evil, I would say. In their day and age, less of it, I would say, is evil in the sense that it's not coming necessarily from a place of evil. It's not coming. It's not driven by the id. It's driven by the id plus society telling you almost that this is within the realm of this. Your superego could tell you to do this. Or your ego could tell you to do this. So I think we need to distinguish evil outcomes from evil tendencies. And I'm more interested in the tendency part than the outcome part. The outcome part is that's how thought, the history of thought, changes and in turn changes the outcomes. That's why you can have moral progress, because our thoughts about what is good and what is evil change and hopefully change for the better. That's why we don't do human sacrifice anymore. That's a great innovation in thought that also led to an innovation in action. But the desire that led to human sacrifice is still very much in our hearts and in our society. And maybe it doesn't express every day in such a vivid form, but it's still there. So we need to think about the consequences of that in terms of why do we scapegoat one another? When do we relish violence? That kind of thing.
So much more to say. Fascinating discussion, gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining. Guys, if you enjoyed it, you can have your own discussion on Chronicles on our WhatsApp group chat. Links in the bio. And there is more content to come in the video format. So keep your eyes peeled for that. All right, everyone. Have a good one.